Now it's time for the magazine, and the editor this week is Felicity Stevenson. Articles include Four Ages of the Human Brain, The Story of the Boy Bishops, Let Sleeping Dogs Lie, Lose Weight with Skinny Jabs, Saving Carols from Obscurity, Is It True You Should Take Vitamin C When You've Got a Cold, Which Animal Has the Best Sense of Hearing, and How Did the Teddy Bear Get Its Name? Carissa Wong, writing in The New Scientist, tells us how human brains undergo four dramatic periods of change from age 0 to 90. Our brain function is far from static throughout our lives. We already know that our capacity to learn and our risk of cognitive decline varies as we age. Now, scientists may have uncovered a reason why. Our brain wiring seems to undergo major turning points around the ages of 8, 32, 66, and 83. The brain has distinct regions that exchange information via white matter tracts, structures made of spindly projections called axons that project from neurons. These connections influence our cognition, but it was unknown whether major shifts in this wiring occur throughout life. To find out, Alexa Moosley at the University of Cambridge and her colleagues analysed MRI brain scans from around 3,800 people in the UK and United States, who were mostly white and ranged in age from newborns to 90. The researchers found that among people who reached 90, the brain's wiring has generally undergone five main phases, separated by four turning points. In the first phase, which occurs between birth and around 9 years old, white matter tracts between brain regions seem to become longer or more convoluted, making them less efficient. It takes longer for information to pass between regions, says Moosley. This could be because our brain is packed with lots of connections as infants, but as we grow and experience things, the ones we don't use are pruned away. The brain seems to prioritise making a broad range of connections that are useful for things like learning to play the piano at the cost of being less efficient. During the second phase, roughly between 9 and 32 years old, this pattern seems to flip, which may be driven by the onset of puberty and its hormonal changes influencing brain development. Suddenly, the brain is increasing the efficiency of the connections, says Moosley. This may support the development of skills like planning and decision-making and improvements in cognitive performance, such as working memory. The next phase is the longest, spanning from 32 until 66. In this phase, your brain is still changing, but much less. Specifically, connections between brain regions switch back to gradually losing efficiency. It's unclear exactly what drives this shift, but the 30s map onto a lot of different major lifestyle changes, for instance, having kids, so that could play a role, says Moosley. It could also just be down to general wear and tear of the body, says Katia Rubbia at King's College London. In the final phase, from age 66 to 83, the team found that connections between neurons in the same brain region seem to be more stable than between those in distinct areas. In the final phase, from age 83 to 90, connections between brain regions weaken and increasingly pass through hubs that connect lots of areas. It suggests that there are fewer resources to maintain connections during this phase, so the brain relies more on using certain regions to act as hubs for connections, says Moosley. Understanding the normal turning points will help us find out what deviates during neurodegenerative or mental health conditions, says Rubbia. Once you understand what's deviating, that can help you pinpoint ways to treat it.
Writing in Country Life, Matthew Dennison tells the story of the boy bishops. John Gregory, a 17th century scholar cleric, discovered that the Christmas custom of the boy bishop, a young chorister who briefly took the bishop's place, was more than a piece of festive dressing up. Granted, each year the boy in question must bear the name and hold up the state of a bishop, answerably habited, with a crozier or pastoral staff in his hand and a mitre upon his head. More importantly, however, with the exception of celebrating Mass, he must also officiate at whatever service the very bishop himself was to have performed. His period in office began on the 6th of December. It was the feast day of St. Nicholas, the patron saint of children, and boy bishops were sometimes called Nicholas bishops. For 3 weeks, the boy bishop exercised sway, his tenure spanning many of the celebrations of Advent and Christmastide. On his final day, he preached a sermon and processed through surrounding streets, blessing all he encountered. It was Holy Innocents' Day, December the 28th, another child-focused festival of the Church, sometimes called Childermass. Evidence indicates that the boys who fulfilled the role were chosen with care. Far from subverting the ordinary workings of the church, they took their duties seriously, being experienced as choristers, altar servers, or acolytes. In many instances, these youthful prelates were held in high esteem. As late as 1518, the statutes of St. Paul's School required that its pupils should, every Christmas day, come to Paul's Church, St. Paul's Cathedral, and hear the child bishop's sermon, and after be at High Mass, and each of them offer one penny to the child bishop. In 1396, John de Cave was chosen as the boy bishop of York. Among expenses associated with his episcopacy were the provisions made by the City of York to guarantee his physical comfort and well-being. In addition to a lamb's wool overcoat and furs to wear, faggots, sea coal and charcoal were supplied for heating his lodgings and cooking. Given the standing of bishops in the medieval church, it's no surprise that the boys chosen to take their place for the Christmas season were well treated, including being provided with vestments of some splendour. The boy bishop of Lincoln wore a cope of red velvet, and his counterpart at Magdalen College donned Oxford ceremonial garments of red, white and crimson, bordered with velvet and damask. Child-sized mitres, too, were sumptuously decorated. A mitre intended for a boy bishop, either of Beverley or York, was described in an inventory as well garnished with pearl and precious stones, with notches of silver and gilt. As the bishop himself was attended by cathedral canons, his chaplain or other clergy, so the boy bishops had their own attendants, invariably their fellow choristers. They too wore specially made vestments, including a striking blue damask albs at Magdalen College, Oxford, or blue and red silk cope embroidered with branches and flowers in York. For past generations of worshippers, the tradition of the boy bishop was easily justified by scripture. In Matthew's Gospel, the disciples asked Jesus, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" In response, St. Matthew tells us, "Jesus called a little child unto him, and set him in the midst of them, and said, Verily I say unto you, except ye be converted, and become as little children, ye shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven." To his temporary role, the boy bishop, childlike in his lack of cynicism or worldliness, brought a freshness of outlook, sincerity of faith, and ideally, freedom from corruption. Echoing their adult counterparts, boy bishops visited areas and communities within their locality. Often they distributed presents to the poor, including gifts of food. Coin finds in Suffolk indicate that at the Abbey of Bury St Edmunds, one of the richest in pre-Reformation England, specially minted coin-sized lead tokens were given to townspeople during the festive season to exchange for food in the abbey's almonry. For the most part, the boy bishops were themselves recipients of gifts. On St. Nicholas's Day in 1299, Edward I attended Vespers in a chapel outside Newcastle upon Tyne. Officiating at the service was the new boy bishop, whom the king rewarded with a payment of 40 shillings to be shared with the choristers. As boy bishop of York at the end of the 14th century, De Cave received presents throughout his tenure. Gifts for the teenage prelate ranged from a silver spoon and a silk purse to a pair of spurs, a Christmas hoard the value of which was estimated at an impressive £77. Gainsayers were mostly in a minority, and the custom of the boy bishops enjoyed long popularity. Henry VIII, however, took a different view, and following the break with Rome, abolished the tradition, describing the boy bishop's role as unfitting, and rather to the derision than of any true glory of God or honour of his saints. It would be one of the several superstitious observations Henry required to be clearly extinguished throughout his realms. Happily, more recent views have been less censorious. In 1986, the Hereford boy bishop was among the folk customs celebrated in that year's Christmas stamps issued by the Royal Mail.
Let sleeping dogs lie. A furry hot water bottle or a restless snoring pest. Sharing a bed with a dog isn't ideal for everyone, but it certainly warms the soul, says Bethany Stone, writing in Country Life. Humans have long been concerned with vetting the company they keep. It's woven into our nature by well-worn, oft cautionary adages. A rotten apple can spoil the barrel. The devil you know is better than the one you don't, and someone who chooses to lie down with dogs can expect to wake up with fleas. Indulgence and curiosity compel us to bend these rules, and in the case of dogs and sleeping arrangements, in a very literal sense. In the 2nd century, Arrian, a Roman civil servant, wrote extensively on training and caring for vertragi, the hounds kept for hunting and coursing purposes. He suggests the dogs should be allowed to sleep in their owners' beds, as there is nothing like a soft and warm bed for greyhounds, but it is best for them to sleep with men, as they become thereby affectionately attached. Which perhaps goes to prove that the way we treat our pets has not changed so much over the centuries. For Devonshire author Callie Coles, no line is drawn between the doghouse and family home. With a trio of whippets, a brace of terriers, a dachshund and a labradoodle among the 8 strong pack, nowhere is off limits to anything with 4 legs, including the children's ponies, who wander freely in the house. At the moment, the whippets and dachshund sleep in the kitchen, the others in the boot room, relays Mrs. Coles. But I love dogs in the bed. When it's cold, they're a hot water bottle. Another heartbeat is always helpful for sleep, especially when Toby, my husband, is away. When asked who would be ejected from the bed first, Mrs. Coles is unequivocal. The children! There's no peace with that noisy rabble about. Historic dog sleep data is scarce, but more recently surveys posit that anywhere between 1/2 and 3/4 of owners share a bed with their dog. In fact, one research paper touts canine bed sharing as equally worthy of study as co-sleeping with children. The subject of dogs in beds fascinates us and is by no means an underground phenomenon. For 20 years nearly, I had a no bed rule, reveals Caroline Munby, a Dorset dog enthusiast. Then I rehomed Mina, a Rottweiler, in 2013. She immediately clambered onto the bed and buried herself under the covers. Soon, Pudding, a Teckel, joined the throng, and given her diminutive size, she needs a boost. When it's time to bed, Pudding runs to my side of it and asks to be lifted up. For gun dog trainer Susie Stewart, a horror film broke the habit of a lifetime. A friend took me to see The Silence of the Lambs and I nearly freaked myself out, she explains. Her black Labrador, another pudding, ended up in the bed and that was it. Once a Labrador's been in bed, there's no going back, she laughs. Some owners, of course, are reluctant adopters of the trend, with even the most stoical of couples giving in to the proliferation of yapping and scratching at the bedroom door. These dogged souls eventually roll over and accept the inevitable, some even buying new beds to accommodate a canine occupant. Have dogs always had a paw in bed sharing? Records are patchy at best, but we know various toy dogs, or comforters, were constant companions and fellow inmates of Mary, Queen of Scots, when she was Elizabeth's prisoner for 18 years. It is believed that one intrepid creature was even found among her skirts, whimpering and covered in blood, after she was beheaded in 1587. Dash, a tricolour King Charles Spaniel, was the closest companion of a young Queen Victoria. The Queen doted on him, even leaving the celebrations for her coronation at Buckingham Palace to bathe her beloved pet. Nothing explicitly tells us Dash made it into the royal bedchamber, but it said that Victoria's first act as Queen was to have her bed removed from her mother's room. I can't help but wonder if the young monarch made space instead for her favourite pooch. Winston Churchill had a particular fondness for poodles. One was his almost constant companion throughout the Second World War. Rufus went almost everywhere with him, apparently occasionally cozying up to him in the ministerial bed. Boundaries were set, however, when the presumptuous poodle trotted into the cabinet room at 10 Downing Street. "No, Rufus," Churchill reportedly said, "I haven't found it necessary to ask you to join the wartime cabinet." "There's something comforting about waking up and hearing a little dog snore," notes Miss Stewart, whose current sleeping companions are Bedlam and Riot, a working chocolate Labrador mother-daughter duo. "You get to a point where you don't fancy sleeping alone, and dogs have better manners than men by far," between her and her husband, Will, in the middle of the night. "She'd use her body weight to force Will out of bed," recounts Mrs. Bladen, adding that Moose now sleeps in the kitchen of their Hampshire home. With comforts manifold and joys bountiful, it's worth daring to lie down with the dogs, albeit not on a hearth, rug or kitchen floor with a lowly hound. Instead, provision is made upstairs for a pooch-shaped bedmate. It's not a case of lying down with dogs at all. Rather, the dogs are invited to lie with us.